Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to my program, the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It is July the 8th, 2016, the day after the attacks on the Dallas Police Department on July the 7th of this year. I usually begin my program by saying Happy Friday. It's difficult to feel happiness in the aftermath of that unthinkable tragedy. I spent 30 years as a federal agent. I spent many of my working days out on the street with members of the New York City Police Department and other state, city, local police departments as well. Law enforcement is a tough profession. We expect of our fellow officers integrity, bravery, the willingness to put their lives on the line for the greater good. It's been said that law enforcement officers are those folks who run toward that which any sane person would run away from. And boy, did we see that last night. And some of those cops who ran towards the gunfire are no longer with us. 12 cops shot, 5 dead. It's just hard to come to terms with it. I've lost friends in law enforcement. My good friend Everett Hatcher, a DEA agent, shot in the head by a mobster by the name of Gus Faraci, other people in law enforcement, the police officer Cecil Sledge, Frank Sledge, killed when he was dragged by his gun belt to his death after stopping a street punk in Brooklyn. So, you know, this is part of what law enforcement is about. It's not unlike being in the armed forces. Some friends of mine have described being a federal agent or a police officer as being comparable to the men and women in the armed forces. Same battle, just a different battlefield. And indeed, downtown Dallas last night was a battlefield. So that's where we begin this evening. I thank you for joining me. Those of you not familiar with me, I started saying that I'm a retired senior special agent, or that I had been a federal agent with the INS. 30 years with that agency has taught me quite a bit. I was an inspector for 4 years. I was an adjudicator for a year. Spent 26 years as a special agent, half that time with the Drug Task Force. I've arrested terrorists and murderers and drug dealers and child molesters. I've also arrested people simply working illegally. So it really ran the gamut. And that's what I've been trying to do, is to provide my perspectives that I acquired throughout not only my 30-year career, but in my dealings with members of Congress and other political entities around the country where immigration is concerned. So a lot of mileage under the hood on this odometer. And today we're going to talk about some of those issues. But first, I want to tell you about the websites I very much would like for you to go visit. My own personal website, Michael Cutler, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. For many years, I have been affiliated with, as a senior fellow, a terrific organization headquartered in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California, Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org. I also write for Front Page Magazine, sponsored by the David Horowitz Freedom Center, The Social Contract, and most recently, and I'm very excited about this also, I have been invited to write for Poliz, P-O-L-I-Z. It's a spinoff of a website created by Laura Ingraham, the radio talk show host and attorney, and when you look at her background, truly impressive. So I'm writing for her organization some articles. I hope this will become a continuing situation. I just wrote an article for them, in fact, Sanctuary Cities Threaten American Lives. And then the tagline, Senate Democrats vote to protect bastions of crime, violence, and danger from the law. It is truly an upside-down situation. Also, this past week, I wrote two articles for Front Page Magazine. One released Gitmo, that's to say Guantanamo, detainee goes missing in Latin America, how Obama's dash to release terrorist suspects from Guantanamo threaten U.S. national security. I also wrote for them nearly 1 million illegal aliens at large and 170,000 are convicted felons ignoring orders of deportation. Finally, Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org, published my article. DHS nominates manager who shielded terrorist suspect from the Joint Terrorism Task Force, has been nominated for the Secretary's Award for Valor. And it's crazy. And the lunacy keeps on happening. And you sit here looking at the madness and you say to yourself, what in the world is going on? When will we restore some common sense and some integrity to the political process? If there's anybody who wonders why Americans have lost faith in their government, those headlines tell quite a bit. You have criminals in custody and we release them for what good reason? We have Americans out of work and we import more foreign workers. Think about what we're doing. And think of the ramifications it has across the country. The open borders anarchists, and indeed they are anarchists, accuse anybody who says, let's secure the borders and enforce the laws, of being anti-immigrant, of being haters. That's a lie. It's a blatant lie, and they know it, and they're lying every time they say it. But, you know, it's kind of like the Nazi regime, and I'm not comparing them to the Third Reich, but it's the tactic that disturbs me. Tell a lie. And the bigger the lie it is, the more you get away with it, if and only if you repeat it at every opportunity. So everybody thinks that anybody who says secure the borders, enforce our laws, is a bigot, is against immigrants. We admit more than 1 million lawful immigrants every year. We're admitting more foreign workers each month generally than the number of new jobs we create. And herein lies the nexus, well, one of the nexuses, nexi, I perhaps should say, between immigration and what we are witnessing in America's minority communities right now. Poverty levels are increasing. In New York City, for the first time that I'm aware of it, at least since I'm on this earth, and I've been around quite a while, the middle class is in the minority in New York City. America was built by a huge, upwardly mobile, thriving, and vibrant middle class. The middle class is associated with democracy. The middle class is associated with the American dream, that you start small, work hard with a little bit of luck and skill and training, and maybe a little bit of chutzpah, a little arrogance to think you can do it. Anybody could write the next success story. That's not happening, not the way it used to. And a big part of it is because American workers are being displaced by foreign workers. And this is not a statement of xenophobia. I'm not blaming the foreign workers. They are the only rational people in the whole story. They're the only ones who make sense, and I mean that sincerely. They are operating in their own best interests. That's what people generally do. Only an idiot does things that do harm to them. Nobody makes the effort to hurt themselves unless they're in need of a room with padded walls. People that are being exploited and downtrodden can't catch an opportunity in their home country, come to America. They might realize they're being exploited. They're not happy about it. But compared to their lot in life back home, America provides that which their home countries are not providing or have not been providing. So they're here. And they are welcomed by our political parties from both sides of the aisle. When politicians stand there and say, well, we can't deport 11 million, folks, there's probably 30 to 40 million illegal aliens in the United States. So they tell you, well, we can't arrest them all. The head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, Sarah Saldana, went before the Senate. And I've talked about it before, and I don't want to be repetitious. But she admitted that she had given $113 million back to the government or redirected it, because she said that she thought we actually didn't have 11 million illegals, but 15 million. But if we can't arrest them all, we're not going to arrest anybody. That's nuts. That's crazy. The excuses are phenomenal. They blow my mind that they would have the temerity to say these things in public. But they do, and nobody calls them on it. the shooting happened yesterday in Dallas. And already the White House had a conference and a news conference. Says, oh, no evidence of terrorism. Trying to figure out if three other people taken into custody are affiliated with the shooter or maybe participated in the shooting. But the White House immediately rushes to the microphones and says, no terrorism here. No terrorism here. No terrorism in Benghazi. What are you going to believe? Me or you? Your eyes or my lying voice? And not my lying voice, but the lying voice that emanates from the administration. How in the world has anyone made a determination that there's no terrorism involved? Do we know for certain who the other people are? Why they were part of this? Maybe, maybe not. Too many questions, no answers, but we have presumptions coming out of the White House because the White House is all about spin. It's all about spin. How do we twist things to political advantage? Not surprisingly, already Mr. Obama is out there saying, oh, see, it's those long guns. It's the guns. Listen, this really has to stop. There was a hearing involving James Comey yesterday. I watched some of the hearing. It was long, amazing. But most of the Democrats who asked Comey questions didn't ask anything about Hillary. Let's steer the conversation away from Hillary. So it was focused on police shootings of black men. What is the FBI doing about that? That's not what the hearing was about. I understand the concerns. And, you know, anybody who is wrongfully killed, you know, not self-defense, not some guy pulling a gun. If the police make mistakes, and they do, they're human, then there's accountability. And the system does provide that accountability. But it is remarkable that the hearing wasn't about that issue. The hearing was about Clinton and the emails. So let's distract everybody. Let's keep going with this narrative. What are you doing about police shootings? What are you doing about homegrown terrorists? God moves you, admit the terrorists actually come into the United States from someplace else. Homegrown terrorists, including people who come here when they're 20 years old, like Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, came on a student visa from Pakistan at the age of 20. And we had a police commissioner here in New York City, very sophisticated department, calling him a homegrown terrorist. In whose home was he grown? So everything has a political connotation. Now, of course, I expect politicians to play politics. You know, when you're a hammer, everything is a nail. And when you're a politician, it's all about the game. Except this is no game. So why don't we look for a moment, because immigration is my area of expertise, unlike some of the talking heads on TV. So let's look at precisely how immigration figures in what we are witnessing in the minority communities. Most people don't know much about the minority communities. They drive by, maybe. And if they do, they roll the windows up and try to get through those neighborhoods as quickly as possible. But as an immigration agent, I can't tell you how many hours I spent on foot in those neighborhoods, climbing into those buildings, in some cases chasing people down the block or up on rooftops, interviewing people in the apartments. It was never a feel-good day walking into those neighborhoods. This was not the house that you'd find in Better Homes and Gardens, let me tell you. You walk into a tenement, one of my buddies referred to it as the stench of poverty immediately grabs you. The stench of poverty is the stench of filth, rat droppings, rotting buildings, damp, dank, miserable surroundings, freezing cold in the winter, sweltering hot in the summertime. It's awful. It's awful. You go into an apartment, they flip a light switch on, and you're treated to what we used to call the moving wall. There are so many insects encrusting that wall, and when the light goes on, wham, they're off to the races. It looks like the football stands with the fans doing the wave. Imagine living in that apartment. Imagine living in that apartment. Imagine coming home from school, coming home from whatever you're doing that day, getting undressed, going into a shower. It's filthy. Bugs everywhere. The stench everywhere. Then you try to clean yourself up, and you go to bed that night, and there's bugs crawling on the bed. What do you do? Half these kids are living under poverty conditions. Violence is pervasive. Most of the people out there aren't working. There's no role models or precious few role models. And these kids are scared, and they're angry. They feel helpless. You talk to so many of those kids, the despair fills your heart. It breaks your heart. And those children aren't any smarter or any dumber than any other American kid, although there have been studies done that says that poverty reduces children's IQ by, I think it was 17 points, a very disturbing article. But these kids have as much potential as any other child. They're never or almost never allowed to realize their potential. What are their opportunities? What are their opportunities? And so they have no way to make a living, no way to get a job. You know, and I remember this from my youth, and I'm sure this is going to resonate with you. You can't get a job till you have a resume, but you can't get a resume without a job. So what in the world do we do? So I remember as a kid growing up in Brooklyn at the age of 14, I got a job working in a kosher delicatessen. Where else would you expect a Jewish kid from Brooklyn to work? I washed dishes. I fried the potatoes. I served up hot dogs, and I delivered food to the women in the beauty parlors, and there were a bunch of beauty parlors within a few blocks of the restaurant. So I would take a big box of food, sandwiches, and drinks and bring it to the beauty parlors. The women paid me. I got a nice tip. I brought the money back to the boss, and this was how I spent an entire summer working, 6, 7, 8 hours a day working. How to get working papers. That was the real undocumented workers are the kids that were working without working papers, not this nonsense about illegal aliens. But that job taught me how to be punctual, how to answer to a boss and be accountable, how to deal with the public, how to deal with money, how to deal with responsibility. It was a great learning opportunity. And then at the end of the summer, I got a very nice letter of reference from those people that I worked for. And the following summer, I got a job at a day camp. And the day camp led to another part-time job. And then when I was in college, I was able to get a job working for what was then First National Citibank, where we were actually signing up businesses on what used to be called the Everything Card, which was the forerunner of Visa and MasterCard. Now, the reason I'm telling you the story is understand, and I'm sure many of you have similar stories and similar recollections. You get the most menial job in the world, and you get a letter of reference, so you get another job that's a little bit better the following summer and a little bit better the following year. And that's what I did. You work your way up the ladder, starting small, getting that first job, getting that foothold so that you can start to climb the economic ladder of success. And along the way, you mature, and you learn responsibility and accountability and how to conduct yourself. It's an educational experience. And because I had that job with the bank, which was impressive to the federal government because I had to be bonded for that job, I got my college degree, I applied for the federal government, and they looked at my references, one of which being Citibank, First National Citibank as it was then, and I'm sure that that was part of the reason why I got hired because, goodness, there were so many applicants for so few jobs. A little bit of good old-fashioned luck, and those resumes, or that resume that I built, helped. What in the world does a child who lives in poverty with no prospects for employment do to build a resume? How does that child even relate to the necessity of working when so many people living in despair or living on public assistance, no role models except for people who commit crime and they're living high on the hog? Those are the people driving the fancy cars with all the fancy jewelry. The guys have these good-looking girlfriends. And so who are we talking about? The drug dealers, the car thieves, and so forth. What an environment to grow up in. And we're not going to change that level of despair, this downward spiral, until we start putting American children to work and giving them opportunities and getting American families off of poverty so they can move out of these hell holes, these rat-infested buildings. Because these kids that live in those buildings will literally stop at nothing to get out of that environment. And I'm not playing social worker. I'm not playing bleeding whatever. But put yourself in that position. My question to you isn't what would you be willing to do to get out, it's what wouldn't you be willing to do? And all too often, the fastest way to get a quick buck is to violate the law. And so another child with all sorts of potential and promise throws his life down the tubes because they come to dead end after dead end after dead end. And it's disgusting. It makes you want to cry because every child is precious. And then the narrative starts, Black Lives Matter. Every life matters. Blue lives matter. Police officers matter. Because it's the cops on the beat that hold our society together. And you have these politicians saying, oh, we're on your side. We're going to protect you. And what are they doing? They want to provide amnesty for still more illegal aliens who will take still more jobs, bring their children to America. Again, look at what we're talking about. If we legalize 30 million illegal aliens and only one in three has children back home, then you're talking right there, 10 million kids. 10 million. Let me repeat that. 10 million kids coming this way because as soon as we would legalize these people, they can petition the government to have their children and their spouses come here. And most of these families don't just have one child. They have three, four, five children. Imagine 10 million aliens suddenly becoming legal, filing for all their children. And let's say on average we're talking about three kids per family. I think the number is going to be higher. My experience when I've interviewed folks from the third world. But let's be wildly optimistic and say three kids times 10 million is 30 million. Competing for a seat in the classroom. Requiring special assistance. Because as the Congressional Budget Office noted, it costs 20% to 40% more to educate a child who can't speak English. Where's the money going to come from? Where is the money going to come from? The World Bank and the United Nations had noted that the fastest way to increase the flow of remittances, money out of the United States to the third world, was to enact comprehensive immigration reform. So the madness is that the politicians who go into the ghettos on those rare occasions when they campaign, and they'll never be there again, you know, unless there are cameras because there's a disaster, then the politicians go running to get in front of the cameras, people like Chuck Schumer. Get me in front of that camera. Give me that microphone. And they make the speech, I'm here to help you. We're going to get you out of And what do? They get back in their air-conditioned limousines, and they're gone. They're in the wind. And then they bring in more people from other countries who provide more competition for American workers, driving down wages and erasing the American dream. And then you look at the narcotics. And I find it remarkable how corrupt we've become as a society. Great cigarette commercials to convince people not to smoke. People that have that stoma, that artificial hole in their neck, so that they can breathe because they had to have their vocal cords removed. People who have lung cancer, all these terrible commercials. They show the cross-section of a lung after an autopsy. Oh, my goodness gracious. It's unbearable. My dad died of lung cancer. Every time I see those commercials, I get sick to my stomach. They're very effective at convincing people not to smoke. When was the last time you saw a commercial that was that effective warning people about the dangers of cocaine addiction? Warning about the dangers of heroin addiction. Where are we with all that? There's almost no commercials warning about that. Cigarettes? Absolutely. Texting and driving? You betcha. Drunk driving? Every day of the week. But commercials warning about drugs? No way. So the drugs pour into America. The drugs pour into these tough neighborhoods. The kids that are desperate for a buck can make a fast dollar and a big buck helping the drug cartels so they get lost to the streets. Understand what we're doing. We're eating our own. America is eating its own. I'm writing an article that should be published at Polizet, which is a subsidiary of LifeZet. And again, this is started by Laura Ingram on Monday, about how the situation we're in now is a creation of politicians, pollsters, and journalists. We need to have honest conversations about what really needs to happen. But it has to start with providing opportunities. and importing still more workers when jobs are in short supply is insane. Insane. There's no way of explaining it unless the politicians doing it want to see America falter. I was just speaking to somebody in Washington earlier today, and I said, you know, what we really are witnessing are politicians bringing to America what they hope will be low-maintenance voters. And what do I mean by a low-maintenance voter? The average American, when he or she isn't happy with government, complains. The roads need to be paved. The stop signs need to go up. You know, they're adamant. When you have people come to America from the third world where corruption is a way of life, when the government doesn't do anything for you but does things to you, anything that they experience in America is a step up, maybe two steps up from where they were. So they're generally mollified. They generally say, well, it's not as good as I hoped it would be, but okay. And they make very few demands on the politicians. So that means that the politicians that don't give a damn about the constituents or this country, they only care about who writes the checks for their campaign contributions, say, hey, look at that. I can do whatever that guy writing the check wants, and my constituents are happy as clams, or at least they leave me alone. So what we are witnessing is a transformation of the American political culture. From a country of Americans who stood for something, who stood up to their bullies, and look how we're dealing with bullies. Don't you dare do or say anything. Call the authorities. You can't take this into your own hands. So from every which way, America is not only getting, you know, people say they're getting dumbed down, they're getting dociled down. Dociled down. Nothing to see here, folks. Keep walking. Nothing to see here. They tried to pass a bill against sanctuary cities in the Senate a day ago. Think about this. Sanctuary cities. Now, when you think about sanctuary cities, this is what I wrote about for my first article for Polyzet, for LifeZet. I said, you know, think about what a sanctuary is. It's supposed to be a place of safety, serenity, security, calm, peacefulness. It's idyllic, you know. You imagine birds fluttering through a blue sky and butterflies everywhere and beautiful flowers and the aroma that comes with the flowers and the plants and so forth. Maybe a little babbling brook in the background. Sanctuary. These cities are not sanctuaries. They're magnets for criminals, for terrorists, for fugitives. Sanctuary? Kate Steinle, how secure did she feel in San Francisco when that illegal alien shot her and she dies in the hospital or on her way to the hospital, and all she was doing was walking with her dad along the piers in the Embarcadero district of San Francisco? And I've been there. It's a beautiful area. It's a beautiful touristy area, minding her own business. She wasn't doing anything that was inappropriate, anything wrong where you could say, well, foolish, why did she go there? She went to a place that would be no different than a New Yorker going to Fifth Avenue, going to the seaport, you know. Here we are, beautiful neighborhood, everything is well with the world. Shot rings out, Kate Steinle's down. And why was the guy here? Because he had been previously deported 5 times, and he even told the reporters or told the people in court, he specifically went to San Francisco because he knew they wouldn't tell immigration on him. It's a magnet. And the politicians say, oh, we're compassionate. We're compassionate. Tell that to Kate Steinle's family. Tell that to my good friend Don Rosenberg, whose 25-year-old son, who was attending law school, gets run over by an illegal alien, and in trying to flee, runs him over 3 times and kills him on a street corner. Tell Don about the wonders of a sanctuary city called San Francisco. New York is a sanctuary city. I deported a criminal alien from Panama, Ronaldo Rayside. This is almost 30 years ago. It's hard to believe. By coming back illegally, he committed a felony, but he did. He came back, but under Ed Koch, and I liked Ed Koch, but under Ed Koch's sanctuary policies, he continued that program. The cops couldn't tell us they had this guy in custody. Gets arrested twice by the cops. They don't tell us. The third time, he reaches for a 24-year-old police officer's gun. Bullets fly, the cop dies on a street corner. I wind up testifying at the murder trial 20 years later. By a weird set of circumstances, I go into a supermarket, it's snowing. young girl opens up in line, the checkout line. This is 20 years after the death of this police officer. And I zip into that line because I wanted to get home before the streets turned to a skating rink. And there's this attractive young lady wearing a miniature police badge. And I said to her, without thinking, who's the cop? And with a very flat, unemotional voice, she said, my dad. I said, oh. I said, you must be proud of him. She said, nope, he's dead. Flat voice. I said, really? And she said, look, I'm not a bad person. It's just that he died before I was born. I never met him. Turned out she was Officer Robert Machotti's daughter. Not victimless. And so they come up with a piece of legislation that says we're going to defund sanctuary cities. They're breaking the law. And if you look at the law, aiding, abetting, encouraging, inducing, harboring, and shielding illegal aliens entering the United States illegally or continuing to reside here illegally in flagrant violation of law, if you do that, it's a felony. And yet people like Chuck Schumer and all the others, the Gang of Eight, what do they say? Oh, this is anti-immigrant. Oh, if you get rid of those sanctuary cities. That's right. We have to protect the drug dealers. We have to protect the gang members. We have to protect the fugitives of justice from justice. And who are we protecting them from? Immigration agents, because we are the big bad wolves. I say we because I carried that badge for 30 years, and in my heart of hearts, I will probably always be an immigration agent. So we were the big bad wolf. We were the ones that took the drug dealers, the criminals, and terrorists off the streets. It is stunning. And so now you look at the situation in the inner city. Very few jobs, very few opportunities, rampant drug abuse, gangs from all over the world setting up shops in those tough neighborhoods, exploiting the kids, getting them hooked on drugs, because once they're hooked, they're hooked. And you wonder why we have a problem in America. And these kids are angry. They know they're in a no-win situation. And it is so easy to harness angry people and say to them, those folks there, they're the reason. Or those folks over there, they're the reason. I don't even know what to say. I don't know what to say. This is not the America that I grew up in as a young boy in Brooklyn. People tended to believe that the government would do what was in the best interest of our nation. We really did. I know that for those of you not as old as I am, this is a hard concept to begin to comprehend. I remember when John F. Kennedy said we were going to go to the moon before this decade is out. I could still hear that New England accent. And I wanted to be an aerospace engineer way back when. Things don't always go as we planned, but my oldest son is an engineer. My youngest is studying engineering and is halfway through his curriculum. And I envy them because that was my dream. But when Kennedy said we're going to the moon, as audacious as that was in 1961 or 62, I mean, think of where our technology was then versus now. My cell phone has more computing power than the entire Apollo space program. Think about that. But President Kennedy said, we're going to the moon. And after we caught our breath, because it was such an amazing statement, everyone kind of looked at everyone else and said, hell, we're Americans. We could do anything. Hell, we built the Panama Canal. We broke the sound barrier. We launched the first communication satellites. We're Americans. Dr. Salk, an American, came up with the cure or the vaccine for polio. We can go down the whole litany, and I'm not going to. But you get the point. We're Americans. We could do anything. We won the Second World War in 44 months. 44 months from start to finish. Built fleets of airplanes that didn't exist before, fleets of ships. We're Americans. We can do anything. Now, no matter what the politicians tell us, we know it's not going to work. We're going to create the Secure Border Initiative Network, SBI Net, the virtual fence, and we're going to spend all this money on it, and you're going to be safe. And everybody goes, yay. And then they build this virtual fence for about 3 miles. The taxpayers get suckered. The tab is well over $1 billion. The GAO comes in a year or two later and says, well, that fence really didn't stop anybody. Of course it didn't. Of course it didn't. And how did that happen? because the goal of the politicians is to create the illusion that they're answering the demands of their constituents while making damn certain that they don't give a rat's tail about their constituents, with a few exceptions. A few exceptions. My good friend Lou Barletta, formerly the mayor of Hazleton, now he's a member of Congress representing Hazleton. Senator Jeff Sessions, one of my all-time favorite heroes in the Senate, in the House, he's tops. He, Lou, Congressman Steve King, there's a few. Congressman Gosar, there's a few. There's a few. But when you listen to the nonsense being spewed, that it's a lack of compassion when you say, let's make certain we don't let terrorists and criminals into the United States. That's a lack of compassion. And they say it with a straight face, and there are idiots that will actually listen to this garbage and somehow be persuaded. Did we all flunk the wiggle test? If you don't know what that is, you stick your fingers in both ears, wiggle your fingertips. If they touch, you flunk. You have to flunk the wiggle test to believe this. These are the same politicians who tell us we have a shortage of programmers and engineers and scientists. We need to import the world's best and brightest, and we get that nonsense from both sides of the aisle. If there was a shortage, why is it that within the past couple of years, hundreds of thousands of Americans who'd been doing those jobs and doing it well for many years suddenly got fired? And if you believe they were incompetent, why were they then ordered to train their replacements, often from India, if they wanted their severance package? If they're that screwed up, do you really want them teaching the people you've hired to replace them? And why are they being replaced always by people from other countries? Because that's what Alan Greenspan called for. He said we've made a privileged elite out of Americans with skills, and the solution is to stop shielding them from foreign competition, because if we did that, then we could greatly reduce that wage premium they're earning, whereby they've become the privileged elite. That's how Greenspan describes middle-class computer programmers and other high-tech workers, the privileged elite earning this wage premium because they're being shielded. Well, of course they're being shielded. That's one of the main reasons for the immigration laws, is to protect the livelihoods as well as the lives of Americans. And what's he yelling? Shields down. Shields down. Terrorists want to kill us. Drugs are pouring in across the border along with foreign gang members. And Greenspan is telling us we have to take down our shields. The cops tell you, God forbid, there's home invaders in the neighborhood. They're burglarizing houses. They're terrifying families. Lock your door at night. And if it was Alan Greenspan, he'd get up on the soapbox and say, hey, if you lock your door, you're a xenophobe. If you lock your door, you're antisocial. There is such a lack of integrity and honesty to the whole program. It's truly astonishing. It's truly astonishing. And then you find out that ICE knows of 170,000 aliens who've been served with notices to be deported. They've been given their warrants of deportation. And guess what? They never left. And guess what? Nobody's looking for them. So when they call their friends back home and they tell their friend back home, hey, Charlie, you're not going to believe this. Some judge ordered me deported. Doesn't matter. Not one little bit. I can do whatever I want. Come on down. The weather's fine. This simply encourages more illegal immigration, and it certainly encourages criminals and terrorists to come here. When I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee a few years ago, I said that the policies of this administration have in essence fired the starter's pistol for aspiring illegal aliens from around the world. And for these folks, the finish line to that race, the finish line to that race is the border of the United States. Because once they get past the border, they are home free. Home free, free as a bird, nothing to worry about, just no one's going to do anything to them except look to give them permission to work. How does that help America or Americans? How does it help our economy? How does it help that American family that's on the brink of losing their home to foreclosure? What does that do? What in the world does that do? And therein lies the problem. So you have kids in these neighborhoods, feeling nothing but despair and hopelessness on a day-to-day basis. I know when I was in those neighborhoods and you spoke to those kids, you saw the sadness in your eye, in their eyes, you saw the anger in their eyes, and you knew nothing good was going to come of this. These kids have no alternative, no way out. No way out. And yet we keep bringing in more foreign workers, whether it's to mow lawns or work in restaurants, work in the few factories that remain. We need to bring in more workers, even though statistics run as high as maybe 95 million Americans of working age are not working. They've left the labor force. And they don't get counted when they talk about the unemployment statistics. Hell no, because if you did that, the unemployment numbers would probably look closer to 30%, especially in the ghetto. And so you wonder why we have the rioting and why there is this friction in the minority communities with the rest of America, with kids that make dumb mistakes. Now, I'm not giving cops a pass. There are cops out there who shouldn't be cops. But the numbers are small. Even one is not acceptable. But every profession suffers that way. And I was talking to Don Rosenberg, and I just mentioned Don a little while ago. His son was killed by an illegal alien in San Francisco. And I said to Don, because we had this conversation, I said, you know, even if it's one person who's killed, it's absolutely one too many. It disturbs me. Thank God I never had to fire my weapon at a human being as an agent. I came close on a couple of occasions. And I remember not being happy. I remember sweat running down my back because no rational person wants to shoot another human being. But, you know, the deal that we have here is that there are other professions that are far more damaging to Americans, and no one says a word. And in our conversation, I said to Don, you know, someone ought to look up how many people die because of medical malpractice. And he started laughing. He says, Mike, I actually did some research in the past couple of days on just that topic. And the number was well over 200,000. Catch that. Well over 200,000 people. I think the number was 235. 235,000 people lose their lives every year because of medical malpractice. The doctor who's lazy, stupid, doesn't know what he's doing, forgets to notice some symptom, whatever. Medical malpractice. Nearly a quarter of a million people every year are killed that way. Do you realize how insane this is? Those doctors that are that screwed up probably shouldn't be doctors. But that number so far and away eclipses the number of people killed by police officers, and it leaves you scratching your head. Now, again, I will continue to repeat this. Any police officer who treats anybody disparately because of race, religion, ethnicity is wrong, period. Any cop who shoots somebody without understanding the totality of the situation has a problem, and he's creating a problem for the people that he might hurt. Absolutely. But you need to understand that these police officers are in the tiny minority. Not making an excuse for it, not by anybody's stretch of anyone's imagination. But let's keep our eye on the ball. Because most of the kids that are in distress in those neighborhoods would not be if they had a place where they could get that first, second, and third job, to build that resume, to learn responsibility, to know what it is to set an alarm clock and go to work and answer to a boss, because that's what we're all in preparation for, isn't it? To grow up one day, to fly out of that nest, get a job, and begin our careers. That's what it's about. But how do you make that transition when there's no stepping stones? There are no jobs. There are no letters of reference. There is no resume that can be built. And these same politicians want to flood America with unknown millions of foreign students who are only going to further erode the educational system, going to create more competition for American workers, more competition for that seat in that science class. Maybe it's an elective, you know? Why would our government do this to us? This is certainly not something being done for us, is it? So time and again, you look at the madness and you say, what are we doing? We have to deal with sanctuary cities. We have to deal with the criminal aliens that are released. And then we get to a story about this suspected Al-Qaeda sympathizer, member, whatever you want to call him, gets released in 2014, and he goes to Uruguay. Everything's cool, and now they've lost track of him. They said, oh, he might be going to Brazil. And what many people don't know is the tricorder region of Brazil, where Brazil connects with Argentina and Paraguay, have training camps run by Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, perhaps ISIS, and that's in Brazil. And once in Brazil, they have two choices. They can get a fake passport, fly anywhere in the world, or they can head north, cross the U.S.-Mexico border, and they're in, waiting for that phone call, waiting for that tap on the shoulder, waiting for an email. Could be a long wait. And meanwhile, think of what this does to America's national security and public safety. So you have children in poverty, and they've become convinced that there's somebody to be blamed. So you have this guy, Micah Johnson, who goes out there, got military training, and here's another point that I really have to raise with you. There was a legislative measure going through the House a while back. I think they want to rejuvenate that. They want to try again with comprehensive reform. Lindsey Graham unbelievably says this is what we need. Really? Honestly? But the story that we're now getting about Micah Johnson, the shooter in Dallas last night, and we still don't know about the other three people. But what we do know is that purportedly he was an Army reservist. He did carpentry work, that sort of thing, but still a soldier. And soldiers learn how to handle rifles and handguns and other weapons. Is anyone willing to accept the idea that there is this risk? That it was our military training that enabled this guy to kill five police officers and wound seven others? And what they were trying to do with immigration is to allow illegal aliens to join our military and be put on a path to citizenship. Chuck Schumer favored it. A whole bunch of these characters favor it. It's illegal for an illegal alien to possess a gun or ammunition. Are we supposed to give these folks a waiver which sets a precedent? So now they're going to say, oh, illegal alien, yeah, you can carry a gun because in 2000 so-and-so, a decision was made in this case. And this is, you know, a precedent-setting case. My dad taught me that I would be able to teach people how they should treat me by demonstrating what I'm willing to accept. What exactly are we willing to accept, folks? What are we willing to accept? How much are we willing to give up our lives, our livelihoods, when in reality everything is falling apart? Because we have no control over our borders. We have no idea who's operating inside the United States. We have a president that's been releasing criminals who have been incarcerated in federal prisons because they've been involved with the drug trade. If this gets your motor going as much as it gets my motor going, and I promise you my motor is redlining right now, I hope yours is too. Because I need you to go out there and tell Wendy Long that you want to support what she's doing. Challenge Chuck Schumer for what he's doing. I mean, that's what this is about. I don't care about political party. I care about America. And when you have politicians saying that it's unfair to enforce the immigration laws, when you could see pictures of illegal aliens running around with T-shirts emblazoned with these three phrases or three words, and I'm sure you've seen it, undocumented, unapologetic, and unafraid. could you imagine wearing a shirt that reflected that sort of business where the IRS is concerned? You know, untaxed, unapologetic, and unafraid? Really? We have an obligation to ourselves. We have an obligation to our children. We have an obligation to turn around this government because we are going the wrong way on a one-way street, and we're certainly picking up speed. The tragic murders, and indeed they were murders, they were assassinations, of those police officers has to have every cop on edge, has to call into question what it is our government is doing, not to us, but for us. Serious matters for you to consider. Serious, serious issues, because hanging in the balance are America's national security, the lives of our citizens, and the livelihoods of American workers. If we can't turn this situation around, get those immigration laws to work for us so that Americans get first shot at the jobs, Americans get first shot at the universities and the trade schools, we don't start doing that, I don't want to imagine where America will be by a year from now. We are coming apart. And we're coming apart because instead of uniting us, the politicians and the pollsters who talk very easily about black voters and Latino voters and Jewish voters and Christian voters and you know, overweight and underweight voters and blonde-haired voters, they put everybody in a little cubbyhole. Instead of saying we're all Americans, oh no, you're an American black, you're an American white, you're an American Jew, you're an American Christian. That steady drumbeat of identifying Americans by their race, religion, or ethnicity has got to stop. It's got to stop. And if it doesn't stop, we will pay the price again and again and again, I fear. We've got to stop allowing this to happen, and the way you do it is by letting the politicians know that we're not as stupid as they hope we are. They're getting away with it because no one is saying anything. You know, I feel passionate about it. I've been feeling passionate about this issue going back to the 93 terrorist attacks, going back to 9/11, going back to one attack after another that was either averted or failed to happen because the terrorist was a nincompoop. But they get lucky once in a while, and they've only got to get it right once. And what are we doing to deter this? And the answer is we're not doing anything. You have a president who's out of control, who brings in still more refugees without being able to vet them. Hillary Clinton, who's now defiantly in the wake of the Comey testimony, saying, I didn't do anything wrong. And I'm sure she might even believe it because Comey did not take action. He treated himself, I thought, reprehensibly. It is so obvious that Hillary Clinton did things she never should have done, in my judgment. In my judgment, she had top secret material and higher. Think of all the people who lost their lives gathering that intelligence, or people who will ultimately lose their lives because that intelligence fell into the wrong hands. It's a very difficult weekend coming up, thinking about what just transpired in Big D, as they like to call Dallas, Texas, down there. We really need to wake up Americans. We really need to get Americans to wake up their congressmen and say, we've had enough. We have had enough. Your days of stealing from us are over. Your days for mugging us are over. It's about accountability, and only we, the people, can make those characters accountable, and we must. There's far too much riding on this. If we don't make the politicians accountable, if we can't turn this around, you're going to see more angry young men in these terrible neighborhoods feeling more despair, God forbid, taking more crazy action. Now, I'm not saying this to justify it. There is no justification. There is less than zero justification. But that's where we've become. Fractured, at each other's throats, blaming each other, ignoring the man behind the curtain, you know, ignoring the man behind the curtain. There is no way to justify all the things that I discussed today and then some. And that's the reason I'm happy to write for whatever websites will have me, why I'm happy to do radio programs, and I've been doing one after the other. I know I don't post it on my website in advance usually, but it's about getting a message out there that everybody understands. And the shooting yesterday just brought the issue home once again, making me think about how vulnerable we all are. Look at what just a couple people did to the city of Dallas. Big city, big cosmopolitan city. Just a couple of shooters. And look what happened. And now you have politicians who want to take illegal aliens, put them in the military, provide them with firearms training. What could possibly go wrong? I have no idea where we're going to go from here, but the place that I think we need to go, folks, is to arrange meetings with your elected representatives, your senators, your congressmen, and make it clear to them that we've had it. American children should get first crack at the jobs and the educational programs. That's not what's being done. Because they figured out a way to rig the machines, I'm going to guess, with all the automated voting. God knows who's voting for who. This won't end well if we don't bring it to a screeching halt and demand that our politicians actually represent us. That is, after all, the purpose for my program, to try to make certain our neighbors out there, our fellow Americans, go to our elected representatives and make the demands. You do it politely, you do it in a civil manner. I'm not looking for confrontations. That's not a good thing to do. It's not going to help you any. It's not going to help us any. But you need to sit down with those politicians and say, look, you don't bring sand to the beach. We don't have a shortage of workers. We do have a shortage of jobs. And we certainly don't have a shortage of workers, and it's demonstrable. You can demonstrate it. Because these corporations keep firing Americans by the boatload. These people didn't wake up as lousy workers one day. They've been excellent workers. But the problem is that the people running the companies have come to the unhappy conclusion that they can get more work done by people they're going to pay less money to from the third world, even though the work they do is far inferior to the work Americans do. Bad situation. And unfortunately, all too many of our political representatives are making it worse. So what I'd love for you guys to do, please, go to the websites. Go to my website, michaelcutler.net. Go to capsweb.org, Californians for Population Stabilization. Go to Front Page Magazine, The Social Contract. And again, I'm very proud to be writing for Life Zet, also known as PolyZet, PolyZette. I have an article that went up this morning. I will have another article presumably going up on Monday, which will largely parallel some of the material that I covered today, talking about the pollsters, talking about the mythology of the Latino vote and the black vote, and all this does is fracture our country. Ladies and gentlemen, if we could focus on what makes us more similar than dissimilar, then we will be heading in the right direction. Please keep those police officers and their families in your thoughts and prayers. If you see a police officer on the beat, tell him or her thank you. They are all that stands between us and chaos. They have earned our respect, and we need to give it to them. I thank you for joining me this somber Friday. Hard to be enthusiastic today, but the beat will go on and the battles will go on, but I am convinced that we will prevail. We are Americans. Have a good weekend, everybody. See you here next week at the same time on the Michael Cutler Hour.